See, and there she was, and I knew exactly who had come to pick me up, and I'd never met her before. Did know her husband, had not put a name with a face, and there are several of you that I've met before, and it's awfully nice to see you again. And of course, it's always good to make new friends. And especially enjoy being with Alabama again, and Tom, and Ray, and meeting Dottie. It's going to be a real privilege to hear her this afternoon. But you know, I love these things. I love Al-Anon, and I love Alcoholics Anonymous, and I've been around for about 23 years. And I still have a need in my life for you, and it's important to me to go to my meetings twice a week, and I started an Alateen group last year, and that's been a real blessing. But you know, I find that my program is as strong as I keep in touch and as I keep mindful of all the things that you've shared with me over the years. And some of them, it took me a long time to come to believe. But you know, I cannot really believe anything until I experience it. And I certainly can't share anything with you beyond my experience. And that's what we do. We simply share our experience and our strength and our hope with one another. And God willing, that's what I will make an effort to do today. I was not raised in an alcoholic home. I had a marvelous home. Very beautiful mother, and I had a very handsome father. And he was a man that I learned at an early age I could twist around my little finger. And the only trouble I ever had in life was when somebody said no to me. And, you know, I found out that I could do certain things. Eyelash energy came to me very early in life, and a chin quivering. I didn't know that I was preparing for a life with an alcoholic when I did that. And I could quickly change my father's no's to yeses. And my mother was, she wasn't as cooperative. And she's the one that I remember I had to get even with early in life. She punished me one time and had me stand in the closet, and I cried and blew my nose on her dresses. And that was sort of the beginning of my getting even with people. At the age of 3, I think I started that. I want to tell you something that happened last night. You know, you can tell how strong your program is when you're faced with crisis. They took me out to eat to Denny's after the meeting last night, and I noticed that they had a senior citizens menu, and I ordered something from it, and would you believe that little smart aleck waitress didn't even ask for my ID? And she could have made a heck of a tip, you know. And I'd wake up in the night thinking about going back there and talking to her. But, you know, I didn't realize that all of this love and all of this feeling of security would leave me someday. It was about 6.5 years difference in my brother and I, and 19 years difference in my sister and I. So I always felt that I had a very special place in the family, and I never felt I lost that place. And you know, I can remember when I was about 16 years old being invited to the campus of the University of Oklahoma, and there I met this young man who had just returned from the war, the big one. And I had a blind date with him, and he was standing there in a tweed coat and argyle socks and loafers and smoking a pipe, wearing a fraternity pin. I knew he was studying for a profession, and I thought, that's it. And all I had to scratch out on this little mental checklist of mine was the word tall, because he wasn't very tall. But he was everything that I dreamed of. And that evening he told me how he won the war, and I believed him. And as he kissed me on the cheek and told me good night. He gave me a nickel and he told me to call him when I became of age. Now, that's how long ago it was, a nickel. And that little girl didn't question me when I asked for that senior citizen's breakfast. But I did call him because I went to a girl's school. And boy, you don't forget things like that when you're in a girl's school. And we started dating when I was a sophomore in college and Cleve was a senior in law school in December. And the following June, we were married. And you know, our life was just exactly like I planned and like I dreamed it would be. I was a planner and I was a dreamer. I was thinking this morning when I turned the TV set on, I can remember my favorite radio show when I was a little girl. It was called Let's Pretend. And that's the way I lived. Let's pretend. And I would think about what I would say and I would plan in my mind what you would say. And Cleve followed the script just pretty good. And drinking was not a problem in our life. In fact, it was a real fun thing for me because I was raised in a Bible Belt in a small town in southern Oklahoma. And, you know, I thought it was pretty sophisticated to drink. I had seen it in the movies. And I certainly didn't think it was as bad as all those evangelists who used to come to our town in the summer said it was. Because it was fun. And I felt grown up. And it wasn't a problem. After Cleve graduated from law school, we lived in Tulsa for a year. And this was sort of a fun thing for me. I had my first cocktail party there. And I thought that was pure fun and sophistication. But you know, when he said, I'd like to move back to Warwick and hang out a shingle and practice law, I was all for that. I liked our part of Oklahoma, and I liked being close to my father again because sometimes Cleve said no to me, and sometimes I couldn't change his no's to yeses, and I thought, well, if I were by my daddy. And so we moved back, and sure enough, I could call my daddy. And I could get anything I wanted all over again. I tried to be more selective this time, and I tried not to be... Well, in fact, I learned to be real conniving about it, you know, because I really didn't want to hurt Cleve's feelings. We built a little house, and things were just exactly like I wanted them to be. And now I wanted a baby. And for some reason, it just didn't work out. And I made the rounds of a lot of doctors and specialists, and finally one old doctor sat me down, and he said, Nell, in all probability, you'll never bear a child. And you know, that made me mad. Here was a no in my life that I couldn't seem to change. And the God of my understanding was the God of my youth. And I had come to know a God in this small town in southern Oklahoma at revival meetings in the summer. When they got up and they preached hellfire and brimstone from that pulpit, and they would sing 43 verses of Just As I Am and tell me that if I didn't get to that altar, I might walk out and be struck down dead by a car. And when you're sitting there fanning with a palm leaf fan that has Grantham Funeral Home written on the back, honey, you think about it. So I'd be saved in all three revivals every summer. And my mother took me aside one time and she said, don't you think public confession is only necessary one time? But then a Sunday school teacher told me about my Heavenly Father. And I liked that because I could compare a Heavenly Father with my earthly father. And I thought, if my Heavenly Father's just half as good as my daddy, I've got it made, you know. And with this knowing my life, I went to my Heavenly Father and I thought that he shut a door in my face and continued to say no. And since coming to you, I have come to realize that God's no's to me are merely preludes to a much better yes in my life. Thank God for you. But I didn't know that then, and I was angry. And Cleve was, at that time, county judge, and he told me, he said, I'll tell you what, if you'll be patient, there will be a child come through our court who needs and wants a home as much as we need and want a child. And this happened. Not as soon as I planned, But in December of 1957, a little six-year-old boy did come into our lives, and his name was Mike. Mike's mother had died of alcoholism, and his dad drank too much. And the father's second wife had left him. And this little guy would climb up in my lap, and he'd say, "You're my third mother and the goodest one I ever had." He punched all my buttons, and I wanted to be the goodest mother he ever had. So I decided we wouldn't drink anymore. And I went to Cleve with this. And I said, "You know, in order to give this child a feeling of security, I think we'll quit drinking." And I'll never forget the look on his face. And he said to me, "I won't drink in front of the boy." And I bought that. I thought that was all right. But you know, I never saw him take another drink. I saw the results of uncontrolled drinking, and I didn't know what was happening in my life. I was afraid. I was afraid that people were going to find out. And so the biggest show in my life began. I had to keep people from finding out. Morica's a small town. I can remember how I felt when I'd get up in the mornings and pour a cup of coffee. And, you know, negative feelings had only been with me briefly in my life. I could always change them some way. But now resentment and anger and fear and guilt all came to live with me, and I didn't know why, and I didn't know how to get rid of these feelings. And I certainly wasn't going to talk to anybody about it. Because here we had just adopted this little boy, and I didn't want him to know what was going on at our house. I can remember I'd be afraid to ask Cleve, but sometimes I would. I was afraid that he'd tell me the reason he drank too much was me. But he'd tell me it was pressures at the office, and he didn't get to play golf anymore. And he needed a quick pick-me-up, or he needed something that would help him rest at night. And I would buy these excuses, and I would believe him when he would tell me he'd try to do better. And about 3 years after we adopted Mike, we had an opportunity to adopt a baby girl, and I went to him again, and I said, "I want this little girl. I feel like she's ours. But I don't want to bring her into this home if you're going to keep drinking like this." And of course, he had promised me again that things were going to be different. He said, "I'm going out of public office into private practice. And I'm not going to have the pressures. And things are going to change now. And let's go after that little girl." And we did. We drove several hundred miles and picked up a 3.5-pound baby girl and brought her home. And I've often said, who but an alcoholic and his sick wife would do that? But we did it with all the faith in the world. And I was so happy. I had a little boy and I had a little girl and I had a husband who had promised me that he was going to quit drinking so much. And that our life was going to change. And honey, he didn't lie. It changed. It got worse. Now by this time, people were finding out. And this really created a new role for me. Because I started going to town without makeup. And I'd walk up and down all two blocks of Main Street, and I'd hear the people in the shop say, "God love her. Bless her heart." And invariably I'd go in and somebody would put their arms around me and they'd say, "How do you stand it?" And I'd just flop my head over there. "I don't know." It was just wonderful. You know how we love that pity. In fact, when I came to you, you know, you hear a lot of Al-Anon say how they were full of hate and resentment and anger. Boy, I wasn't. I was just precious and pitiful. Everybody in town had told me I was, you know. But I didn't know where to turn. And I went to my doctor and I went to my minister and they would answer my questions with questions and they'd say, "How do you stand it and why do you stay?" And I'd leave their office feeling guilty for loving a drunk because I didn't know why I stayed. And you know, I didn't know for a long, long time why I stayed. Didn't find out, in fact, till I came to you. And I discovered that I stayed because I was emotionally dependent upon him at that point in my life to fulfill all of my neurotic needs. And I think had that man sobered up, I would have gone stark raving mad. Alcoholism is a family disease. And I really wasn't ready to hear the answers for me because I was looking for the answers for him. We had one couple in Waurika who were attending AA and Al-Anon in Wichita Falls, Texas, and they asked me if I would like to go to an Al-Anon meeting. Now, I didn't know what this was. I'd been to an open AA meeting or two and thought that they were pretty nice. But I wasn't real sure that Cleve was one of them, you know. I just thought if he'd quit drinking and straighten up, everything would be all right. So I went to this Al-Anon meeting, and I walked in that room, and here were the loveliest bunch of ladies, and they were smiling, and I liked that. I liked it when they smiled, because I was always a little warped, you know, and I laughed at the wrong time, but I liked for people to smile. And besides, I found a group of people who hadn't heard what I was going through. You live in a small town and you soon wear everybody out, you know. So I proceeded to tell them. And I can remember how rude the chairman was that night. She kept interrupting me and trying to get hold of her meeting again. And they'd talk about the principles of the program and they'd talk about the steps. Well, that would give me a little breathing, you know, space and time to think up something else that I felt that they needed to know. And finally, I did read their steps. And I liked number 12. It said something about carrying the message, and I knew why I was there. I thought, this is where you go to find out how to sober up the drunk. And I wouldn't miss a meeting. And I couldn't wait to go to an open AA meeting because Cleve wouldn't go. And I had a most retentive mind then, and I could memorize everything the AA speaker said, and I would share with him when I would get home. And they told me in Al-Anon, whatever I did, to do it with love. So I would preface everything. Now, Cleve, I love you, but... Or, Cleve, I love you, and I have a wonderful message that I'd like to share with you this morning. And this would be over coffee when he wasn't well. And you know how you can tell when someone just kind of shuts you out? Kind of tacky at him, but you know, he'd quit minding long before that. We get used to certain things, you know. But nothing I was doing was helping. And one night, I heard a tape by Chuck C. This talk was made at the top of Texas back in the early 60s, and in this talk, Chuck talked about the prodigal son. And I thought, that's it. If I can get hold of that tape and take that home and let him listen to that, he'll be cured. It'll work. So I got my hands on that tape, and I did take it home. And I offered Cleve this wonderful opportunity to listen to it, and he refused. So, patient as I was, I waited until the next day. And I again offered him opportunity of hearing that tape. And he chose not to listen to it that day. Well, I was getting a little frustrated. And so I dropped it for a day or two. And then again, I would bring the matter up. And again, he would refuse. So they told me in Al-Anon that what I couldn't handle, to turn over to God. And I told God that he was going to have to fix this. That he knew, just as I did, that Cleve needed to hear that tape. So one afternoon when I was at the beauty shop, and you know how we used to sit under hair dryers and read magazines, I found this article. It said, learn a foreign language in your sleep. And I said, thank you, God. And I went home, and I took this tape. Now, this was a reel-to-reel tape, and I wasn't very mechanically minded, but God helped me. And I got this reel on this tape, and I put it under the bed. Now, I had to let him back in the bedroom. You know how we sacrifice. And then when he was asleep, all I had to do was reach down and flick on the tape, and on came Chuck C., the prodigal son, and the whole bit. And I did this for several nights in a row. He soon developed a very deep resentment for Chuck C., the prodigal son, and me. Nothing was working. Nothing was working. I went back to my meetings, and one night I heard a lovely gal say that no one feels as unloved or as alone as the wife of an alcoholic. And I thought, right on. But you know, she added something. She said, unless it's the alcoholic himself. And that broke my heart. Because for the very first time, I could identify with a feeling that Cleve had. And I thought, oh dear God, is he as lonely as I am? And does he feel as unloved as I do? And just that little bitty inkling of compassion crept in. And I went back to my meeting. And I thought I might try these steps, but you know, I still didn't believe I was powerless. I did not believe that my life was unmanageable. I thought I managed beautifully considering the mess I lived in. I can remember how I kept that floor polished, those rugs vacuumed and the furniture polished and those kids clean. My life unmanageable. And I didn't believe in a higher power, and I certainly was not insane. I was a wonderful mother. I kept a bed in the back of my station wagon so that when I had to get up at night and look for their daddy, the little things didn't lose rest. But you know what I remember today? I can remember how they used to beg to stay at home. And I'd say, you certainly don't think I'm that kind of mother that would go off and leave you here alone at night, do you? I don't know what would have gotten them. Rebecca's first sentence was, is he dead? We'd come in, find old Cleve lying in state in the living room floor. She'd say, is he dead? I'd say, no, he just rested. And we're going to play a little game, and it's called Jumping Over Daddy. And I'd jump over him, and I'd kick him as I went over, and I'd say, oops, I missed. I'll have to do it again. You see, they told me in Al-Anon to tell those kids that their daddy was sick. And it confused the little things when I knocked the hell out of their poor sick daddy, I can tell you. You know, they say, look at what that alcoholic's doing to the family. I'll tell you, take another look. I know who did what to my kids. Thank God you gave me a way to deal with that, too. I can remember one afternoon when I was going to have a table of bridge, and Cleve came wandering in drunk. I forgot to tell you now, when he drank, he wore black. Black suit, black high-heel boots, little black string tie and colored glasses and a black hat now. And I stomped a hat and colored glasses one time, made me feel good, just like hitting him did, you know. And he'd leave the house in the morning, and I'd look out, and I'd think, well, if anything happens to him, he's dressed for it. Here he stood that afternoon, and I said, what are you doing home? And of course, I can't really repeat the things that he said when he replied, but he let me know that, you know, he was there, and he was going to stay there, and I said, well, if you are, go to the basement, because the girls are coming, and we're going to play bridge. And for some fool reason, he went to the basement. Never have understood why. Never did mind before, but he went to the basement. The girls came, we set the table up, dealt the cards, and you know how we look. Everything's just all right, dealing those cards. And here comes Mike running in the back door screaming, he's getting out, Mother, what are we going to do, you know? Had him caged, and he was loose. But you know, I think of the situations that I created. Why didn't I let him go onto the bedroom? Because I would have been out of control. We had met a couple at the group in Wichita Falls that I loved very much. Corny died a month ago. But that AA guy was such a wonderful man, and oh, he loved drunks. And you know, the Al-Anons in that group really didn't practice tough love very much. They loved me, but they didn't say the things to me that needed to be said. But the AAs did. Carney and Ruby Dee came to my house one day, and I was in my rocker. Now, this is where you're really pitiful, in a rocker. You know, I rocked old Rebecca till her feet drug the floor. And I'd strike this pose, and especially if anyone was driving up, you know, get in mother's lap, honey, here comes somebody. And I'd get in this rocker, and you soon learn to, you know, just let a tear trickle down one cheek. Or you don't take your makeup off the night before, and then as it runs down, you know, it's smudged a little bit. And if you place that rocker just right, they can see you when they walk in the door, leave that door unlocked, and then when they walk in, they know something's wrong. I just couldn't wait for them to say, "What happened?" Carney never did do that. I always just had to say, "You know what happened?" They walked in. I proceeded to tell them about Cleve's latest escapade. He was in jail and how humiliated we all were. And Carney stopped me and he said, "Now, there isn't anything that you can tell me about Cleve, honey, that I don't already know. You see, he's an alcoholic." He said, "Now, what's your problem?" And you know, I really thank God for that man that day. I thank him for the words that he put in his mouth. And oh, I thank him because I heard what he said. And for the very first time, I knew that Cleve was not my problem. All of these things that you have been trying to tell me in Al-Anon for a little over 3 years seemed to flood my being. And I cried out to the God of my understanding that day. And I said, "God, I've tried to help you and you didn't listen. So I'm going to give Cleve to you." And I think I thought I got even with God that day. But I added something. I said, "Oh God, help me." And oh my, he has. He has. If you're new, and if someone in your life is drinking, I'm not going to stand here and tell you that this will happen in your situation, but I'm going to tell you what happened in mine. You know, I think Cleve felt this release just as surely as I did. And about 2 weeks after I took my first step, he had his last drink. And that was in May of 1965. And we started this walk, AA and Al-Anon, together, each in our own way. Would you believe I didn't even offer to be his sponsor? That showed you how much better I was getting there all at once. Oh, I had so much to work on, I couldn't be bothered with him. Because I believed what you said, that God loved him more than I do. And I wish that I could just tell you all of the things that have happened, good and bad, because, you know, sobriety does not promise us instant serenity or constant serenity. We're going to be living in a world of reality. And that was always difficult for me, this world of reality. I liked that world of "let's pretend." And I was afraid of the world of reality because I knew there would be no's for me. No's that I would have to accept. I had accepted one and God had changed it. But he was also giving me an opportunity to change my life. And I hungrily sought it. I wanted it. I still want it. I had trouble with jealousy. I had trouble with anger, resentment, and there were some things that I found difficult to forgive. And I talked to my sponsor about it. And she said, you know, I've always told you now that anything you can't handle, God can. So get on with what you can do and leave the rest to Him. And oh, the hate that stayed there for so long. And it was eating me up. And I finally did give back to God and work on these things in my life that I knew that I could handle. And the marvelous feeling of forgiveness came to me one day. And you know, I don't know which happens first. Feeling forgiven or being able to forgive. They go hand in hand as far as I'm concerned, and I don't think I would have known one without the other. But you know, it's a miraculous thing to have a healing in a relationship. And my marriage was healed. And it's not going to stay that way if I don't stay with you. And I do not believe that I could be married to Cleve today unless I had you in my life. Because he has grown. And I think we both have to grow in this program. And we did. We learned what love was. From you, we learned how to love one another. And I can recognize him as the child of God that he's meant to be. For that, I am so grateful. Because this man is no longer my Prince Charming or the man of my dreams. He's God's very special child. And I can love him just the way he is. And oh, that's a miracle for me. That is a true miracle in my life. And would you believe he's even better than I planned on him being? God, he's a neat guy. The first of the year, he will step down from the bench. He's retiring. He's not retiring from work because he'll practice a little law now and we have an abstract company. But, you know, I've thought about the last 23 years. And I know that he has mixed emotions in giving up this position because of the alcoholics he's come in contact with every day and that he has worked with and the families that that has afforded me. But life goes on and God will continue to fill our lives with the things that we need. And I'm just so grateful that I can trust this God that you've taught me to love. To me, recovery means telling you about my family because that's where it was really sick. And if I can get along with my husband and my kids, I can get along with the world. And if I can make my amends to my family and try to live and not be that way anymore, I can go out there and be with you. Mike is such a fine young man. We haven't had a drug or alcohol problem with these kiddos. He's married. He has 3 children. And in 3 more years, he'll retire from the Navy. And he'll be home for his dad's retirement party, the 14th of December. And it's been over a year since I've seen him. So you can imagine the excitement at our house. When he was at sea last time, about 3 years ago, he was off the coast of Lebanon aboard the USS Eisenhower, and it was at the time the Marines were all killed when the truck was driven into the Marine barracks. And they were threatening to fly planes into his ship, and I was afraid. And you know, mothers always feel they can protect their kids, and for the first time in my life, I knew I could do nothing. But again, you told me that God loved him more than I did. And with your help, I was able to place him in God's hands. Shortly before Mike came home, I had a letter from him, and he said, Mom, I've been doing a lot of thinking, and I think it's time that I saw my natural father, and he named him by name. So Cleve and I talked about it, and we knew where to go. We knew how to get in touch and get his address and his phone number for him. And because of you, I could do this, simply because I had nothing to lose by it. Mike did come home. And I had the number for him. And I watched him two or three nights in a row as he'd stand by the phone and start to place that call, and just a little bit afraid. He finally made the call, and it was good. This was in December. And he made a trip to see this man. And he said it was the best Christmas present he had ever had. And I knew how he felt. Because you see, we got Mike in December. And he was the best Christmas present I had ever had. I was able to write to that man and thank him for the years. I had nothing to lose. When Mike came home the following summer, he chose to go back. And he said, "Mom, I'm going this week because next week is my birthday. And I want to be here at home for my birthday." Oh, the gift of just loving for free. Where would I have found that? I don't think I would have ever found it without you. Rebecca is somewhat like I was. I've watched her twist her daddy around her little finger for a long, long time. She lives in Wichita Falls, not too far from us, so we see her on a regular basis. And she has a darling baby boy now. Oh, I must tell you, when she married, she had her father march her down the aisle, and then he performed the wedding ceremony. Wouldn't you know, he'd be the whole show. You know who did all the work. But it was beautiful. Wasn't even what I planned or dreamed for, but it was wonderful. And he's such a fine young man. And oh, that little boy. You see, I've never gotten to be around my other grandchildren very much. And up to this point in time, I've been a wonderful mother-in-law and grandmother. And I think that's because they've been in Jacksonville, Florida, and I've been in Warrick, Oklahoma, you know. God's really putting me to test now. But my favorite story about Rebecca occurred when I could actually let her go. And it was one New Year's Eve, and she was dating a young man at that time that I just flat didn't like. I didn't like the way she dressed, and there were just several things that I could have fixed with her. And consequently, we did not have the kind of relationship that I wanted. And I knew what was wrong. But you know, I'm kind of bullheaded even today, and I have to work through those things with God's help. And I was able to leave a little note for her that New Year's Eve and tell her I loved her very much. And I finally could love her enough to let her go and live her life. It changed our whole relationship. She started sending me bouquets of flowers for no reason. And they had the sweetest little notes in them. And I collected quite a nice little stack of forest cards. And her daddy collected a nice little stack of forest bills. That best describes Rebecca. Do you remember the baby I prayed for? In December of 1968, Christopher was born, our AA baby. I had quit smoking and thought I was in nicotine withdrawal. And you know, the first time I held him in my arms, I was filled with the fear and anxiety that I had known many, many years before, because you see, my baby had Down syndrome. And it made me mad at God again. And I told him so. I told him that I just had all the hell that I wanted, and that I'd wanted that baby for a long, long time, and I thought it was pretty tacky of him to pull this trick on me. And Cleve and I stood by that baby's bed day after day, and we prayed for God to change him. Oh, he was a sweetheart. We never rejected that baby. We only rejected the idea that there was something wrong. And miracle of miracles, God changed us and truly granted us the serenity to accept that which we could not change. And you know, I think I truly learned the difference in acceptance and resignation. In acceptance, there's hope. And there's a difference in hope and expectations. In hope, there's trust in this loving God that you have shared with me and that I have come to know. And oh, the gifts of Christopher that I would never have known had it not been for you. I remember they wouldn't give us a little chart or a little book telling us, you know, when he would walk, when he'd crawl, when he'd sit alone or any of those things, because we just didn't know. And I can remember when he sat alone. And I can remember when I held him on my lap and I was so grateful and I thank God that my little boy sat alone that day. And as I held him and as I looked at him and you know how little Downs kiddos look with the little slanted eyes, and most of them have the square, fat little hands. And I was looking at all these so-called physical imperfections and thinking how much I loved him and received perhaps the greatest gift I've ever known. Because as I sat there, it suddenly dawned on me how God loved me. I'd heard it all my life that God loved me, and I believed it, but I truly came to believe and felt His love. Because you see, I'm not perfect, but God loves me, just like I love Chris. And I think God rejoices even though my progress is slow. What greater gift could I have been given? But oh, there have been so many more. And I like to tell them to you simply because it's a way of expressing my gratitude for people like you. I'll never forget his first year at camp. He was 8 years old, and Christopher didn't know what camp was. He called it camp. He called the courthouse the whorehouse. And you know what I did with that? Tell him where Daddy works, honey. And as we got ready for camp, you know, we put the name tags in the clothes and we got a sleeping bag and we'd tell him, Chris, this is for camp. And oh, he was excited. And the day came. We packed it all in the car and we took him to camp and he bailed out of the car and he ran up to the first person he saw and he says, Hi, Hamp. And the gal said, Well, my name is Barbara. And he said, Oh, and we went on into registration, and he went around to each adult at the table, and he'd say, Hi, Hamp, and they would each one tell him their name. And you could tell, you know, that he was beginning to feel a little bit rejected in the cabin. And before we got there, this real fine-looking young man came out, and he had a name tag on, and I ran ahead because I wanted him to know what was happening, you know, fix it. And Christopher ran up to him, and the young man's name was Rick. And Chris looked at him, and he said, Hi, Hemp. And Rick stuck out his hand, and he said, Hi, Christopher, I'm Kemp. And oh, the look on his face, and you know what? I knew how he felt. I knew how he felt, because when I came to you, I didn't know what you were. You held out your arms to me, and you said, Hi, Mel, I'm Al-Anon. And like Chris, I stayed, and I came to know Chris couldn't wait to go back to camp the next year. I can't wait to get back to you anytime. The gifts of Christopher. We were able to keep him at home for 12 years. We had a class in public school, and it was wonderful. And, you know, that little old class of kids was much like our meetings. There was no competition there, and they were all just so thrilled over each other's progress. And I'd like to go to the school and just watch the kiddos through the glass door. And the day came, they told me that they were going to have to give up the class. There was no more money for it. Well, you know how I am. I get mad at God over these things, and I have to tell Him about it, and then I have to get all settled down and wait for His answers again. But you see, I didn't want to give certain things up, like going to the awards assemblies or the assemblies where the kids performed, because Christopher was always a part of that. In the last awards assembly I went to, they had given the certificates to the kiddos who, you know, scholastic awards and athletic awards, and then they gave a little certificate to the kiddos who had read 25 books or more. And you can imagine my surprise when Christopher's teacher went to the podium and she said, "I too have a certificate to give this year. Christopher Largent has read one book." Oh, my heart stood still. And I wondered why I wasn't as grateful when my other two had received certificates for reading 25 or more. The day came, we took him away to school, and would you believe he was excited? He thought he was going to college. And I remember when he packed his little box of toys and he took Bear, and I hated to see Bear go as much as I hated to see Chris go. Bear was a little panda bear that we'd had to sew the legs and the eyes on many times. And he couldn't wait for us to get on our way, because he was getting on with a new experience in his life. And we cried, of course, as soon as he was out of sight, and we started home. But as we talked, it dawned on us that Christopher's happiness did not depend on us. And isn't that a wonderful thing? And I wouldn't have known how wonderful that was without you. You know, Christmas is coming. Christopher sings Christmas carols the year round. You know, he's not embarrassed by it. If he wants to sing Jingle Bells the 4th of July, he sings Jingle Bells. And I can't wait for Christmas, because Christopher and I will stand in line to have his picture made with Santa Claus. And as always, we'll receive some rather curious stares as we stand there, because you see, Christopher will be 18 December the 7th. But I'll watch these stares change to smiles as he visits with them. And as he tells the little ones who are crying not to be afraid that Santa's their friend, and as he sings Jingle Bells, he'll introduce himself up and down the row, and he'll say, "And this is Mama Nell," and I'll make new friends. And I'll stand there as I did a year ago and put my arm around him and pat his face and think, "My God, I'm the only mother in line with a kid that shaves." And you know, it'll be wonderful. And I look forward to it. And I look at these other parents and I think, oh, when your son or daughter is 18 years old, you won't be standing in line to see Santa Claus. The gifts of Christopher, because of people like you in my life. You see, I'll have my family together before long. And I'll sit there and I will look at each one of them. A sober father. A mother who's not quite so nutty anymore. Because the best way I can make amends to my kids is to never be that way again. I'll look at Mike and think about his very special gifts to our family. He came with his very special needs. And little old Rebecca. And Chris. All of these no's in my life that I can see now as God's yeses. Wouldn't have known it. Wouldn't have known any of it unless you had shared your experience and your strength and your hope with me. And because of that, I can be with you today and share mine with you. Thank you.